Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with our analysts, Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hello there, Dave.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on board, as well as Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. He's in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Lots to get to pick apart. A little later in the program, we're going to be talking apart about the fact that Congress is in recess, and we have our elected officials back in their in Iowa, in this case, or across the country, some Republicans facing angry constituents. Lively conversations, let's call it that, at some town hall meetings across the country. Also here in Iowa, we're going to be talking about that. Perhaps you attended a town hall meeting, a forum that included your elected official. What was your experience? What did you go there to communicate to your congressman or senator? 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. That coming a little bit later in the program. First, let's talk about the new developments on immigration. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly unveiling rules aimed at tougher enforcement of immigration laws. The new guidelines call for the hiring of thousands of additional enforcement agents, expanding the pool of immigrants who are prioritized for removal, speeding up deportation hearings, and enlisting local law enforcement to help make these arrests. That's a shift in policy that puts millions of people in the U.S. who are here illegally at risk of deportation. White House spokesman Sean Spicer, here he is speaking to reporters, outlining the administration's priorities for immigration enforcement.
The message from this White House and from the DHS is that those people who are in this country and pose a threat to our public safety or have committed a crime will be the first to go, and we will be aggressively making sure that that occurs. That is what the priority is.
Okay. Dave Anderson, how much of a change is this in our immigration policy?
Well, I don't know that it's – well, it is a big change from what we currently have, but it's really a rollback from a change that the Obama administration put in. The Obama administration years ago had said, you know, we all agree we have at least 10 million undocumented immigrants in the country, and our – border control agents are supposed to be identifying people who should not be here and deport them, but the system is absolutely overwhelmed. So Obama put in some rules prioritizing who we were going to focus on trying to deport. And he said, well, let's focus on people who have committed crimes, particularly violent crimes and drug crimes, because those are people that are harmful for society. So we should prioritize trying to remove them. And this is rolling back that prioritization. This is saying that anybody who really has any contact with the criminal justice system, the new rules seem to be a little bit vague, so it could include traffic violations, which really opens it up for anybody who's undocumented. The big question is any of this really possible? The reality is the immigration system is absolutely overwhelmed. Even with hiring new officers, it just can't keep up with demand.
That's why the Obama administration prioritized here the dangerous elements in these undocumented workers. Tim Hagel, what is your view on this change, and how big of a change is it? Because we had – is Donald Trump prioritizing here, enlarging the pool significantly here? How much of a change is it?
You know, it's hard to say. We certainly have heard a number of people suggest that in using the phrase mass deportations, I don't know that that's going to happen. And it's certainly not going to happen overnight. There's not going to be a situation where people are going to go, people meaning law enforcement is going to go out of its way to find and deport people that may be here illegally. But the question is, will they be able to hire enough new border control and other immigration officers to basically speed up the process and, in fact, get those people that are dangerous to American society. Now, the phrase, again, with the Obama administration, they wanted to deport felons, people committing dangerous crimes. So maybe they're going to expand that to a certain amount. But again, it still remains to be seen how much. But it does have some people worried. And again, some people are concerned that it's going to expand into people that maybe others would not think are dangerous. And whether it's like a traffic violation or something, somebody that doesn't have a driver's license that gets pulled over, we'll have to wait and see if it in fact gets that broad.
Mm-hmm. We know Donald Trump ran on this in the campaign, talking a lot about illegal immigrants in the country. Are congressional Republicans, Dave, let me point this to you, congressional Republicans on board with this policy change? Do we know?
We don't know yet. We know that immigration came up a few years ago, and there was a push for a bipartisan consensus on immigration reform, and it collapsed in large part because the Republican Party didn't have a unified message on immigration policy. It is likely that the Republican Party is going to split on this. Immigration is really difficult, in part because there's no solution to immigration that does not cost billions and billions of dollars. It's really hard to be a fiscal conservative and want to increase the size of our immigration force and want to build a wall and want to do a lot of these enforcement changes. It is just hideously expensive.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading an article just put up on the Hill's website, the news source of the Hill, talking about this being based on some fear-mongering that hasn't really been based in facts. They say here, illegal immigration from Mexico through our southern border is a net negative and has been for several years. So this idea of illegal immigrants flowing over our border hasn't been the case in terms of the back and forth. Tim Hagel, I see you looking skeptically. More are outflowing than are inflowing, I guess, is the way. You would agree with that.
I've seen that, too, and other places have talked about that in terms of the net, but that still doesn't take into account the actual change. But, you know, when you're talking about a net, that means that, well, people are still coming in, but maybe some people are going out as well. But it still means that the border is not secure. And this is, I would say that Republicans are a little less than we don't know what they think about it. They're very concerned about this, too, I think. And for Republicans, it had always been a matter of, well, secure the border. That's what they wanted to focus on, and they would like to try to dodge questions about, well, okay, we secure the border, then what do we do with the how many ever million right. it is people that are here? And that's where Republicans often stumbled a bit in terms of dealing with that particular circumstance. But on the other hand, that's what they've often said, too, is say, well, let's secure the border, then we'll deal with the problem in some particular way.
Mm-hmm. President Trump plans to issue a revised version of his temporary travel ban related to this, targeting majority Muslims, Muslim countries rather, this week. It's likely, according to reports, to focus on fewer people to survive legal challenges. If we remember, the first instituting of a ban led to some chaos in our airports across the country. It was struck down by courts. Also, in this new version, according to reports, has yet to be issued. Unlike the original, people from those countries who already have permanent U.S. residence or visas would not have any restrictions. Dave, do you see this fixing the problem? And also, doesn't it tell us something that it doesn't? Does it appear that the Trump administration will pursue this in the courts?
They are likely to pursue this in the courts. I think the revised executive order is very likely to come out this week. It is unlikely to really solve a problem. It seems to be an action in search of a problem. As of yet, we really don't have any evidence that people are coming from these seven countries to come here and create terrorism. There's conjecture. There's lots of reasons to suspect that it may happen. But there's really no strong evidence that it is happening. It is a solution in search of a problem right now. And the court system may have a real problem with that. Generally, when you make a law or make an executive order, you're supposed to be basing this action on some evidence in reality. And until the administration provides this evidence other than just saying, well, it sounds plausible, it's very unlikely to be supported in the courts.
Tim Hagel, you also have a legal background, I know. Do you see it the same way?
Not quite. Certainly, it's understandable for the public to want to know what the evidence is. But when we're talking about these sorts of national security things, it could be that the president and his national security advisors, now he's got a new one, of course, whether they have additional information that that they either can't share with the public or would prefer not to, or they may not have that information. And one of the reasons that they said they selected the particular seven countries was because they were on the list that Obama was on a list in the Obama administration. administration put together of countries that don't have a sufficiently solid governmental structure to actually be able to vet the people. So it's not so much that they had to be people that were terrorists, that we knew were terrorists coming from these countries, as we couldn't determine whether they were or not coming from these countries. And of course, other people said, well, what about some of these other countries where there are problems with Saudi Arabia or some of the others? And again, we don't know what the current information is, so it's a little hard to say. And I would also say from a sort of a legal perspective that a combination of the Constitution and the particular government statute that Donald Trump cited does seem to give him pretty strong powers in order to make these decisions. And the question would be is that if you think that it's unconstitutional, you have to provide a particular provision. And also there were some questions in both the district judge and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals when they decided as to whether it was actually standing on the part of the University of Washington, University of Minnesota. And of course, the court found that there was, but other legal scholars have suggested otherwise.
I don't know how much you've been looking into, Tim Hagel, with the new version that's to come out, let's call it, I don't know, travel ban 2.0.
Yeah.
2.0, perhaps. We both arrived at that at the same time. That this sidesteps which particular problems that the court had the most problem with, do you know?
You know, I think that what the real problem was for a lot of people, and possibly even why the federal district judge in Seattle decided to allow for the temporary restraining order, was because of the chaos that was involved, that it did seem to involve people that had green cards, people that were in transit. And because the initial executive order was issued so quickly without sort of proper following proper procedures in terms of letting everybody know, here's what we're going to do and here's how you handle these types of situations. And so people didn't think that through. So there was this chaos. And so I think it gave a real difficult perception and allowed the judges to focus on those aspects to it to allow a temporary restraining order. Now, again, that didn't go to the merits of the executive order. And that's what we're not sure. The Trump administration has been a little unclear as to, first they said they weren't going to pursue this, at least the first executive order in the courts. And then they said maybe they were. We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, with this latest order, Dave Anderson, we've seen the first month of the Trump presidency marked by a lot of protests across the country. Do you see this latest, these new guidelines giving more energy to the protesters, another reason to protest?
Sure. I think we're going to see protests continue over the coming months. Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. It was a very close election. And I think that gives a lot of energy to his opponents, and they are going to use almost every action he makes as a reason to protest against him.
Mm-hmm. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dave Anderson from Iowa State University there, where he's assistant professor of political science. Tim Hagel with us from the University of Iowa in Iowa City, associate professor of political science at the UI, picking over this week's politics. We want to talk a little bit about the latest nomination. Actually, nomination. This does not need a Senate confirmation, I believe, if my facts are correct, appointing Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as the new National Security Advisor, a widely respected military strategist known for challenging conventional thinking. Here he is on Monday. As the president announced his new National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster.
Mr. President, thank you very much. I'd just like to say what a privilege it is to be able to continue serving our nation. I'm grateful to you for that opportunity, and I look forward to joining the national security team and doing everything I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people. Thank you very much, sir.
You're going to do a great job.
Okay, Tim Hagel, is this a pick with a background and experience that's likely to steady the boat after the Michael Flynn firing?
I would think so. At least that seems to be the initial perception on the part of a lot of people and getting some bipartisan support. He's known as somebody who has, I've seen a couple of places where they've referred to him as a warrior scholar, that he thinks things through, very strategic. He also wrote a book talking about the weaknesses of the Vietnam War, dereliction of duty. He's said to be the kind of person that speaks truth to power, which means that he'll buck his superiors, which some people feel makes him a good pick to deal with Trump, who many think has been too cozy or too friendly in his words with Russia, as opposed to McMaster, who basically is more skeptical of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps listeners this morning caught the interview that Steve Inskeep did with Admiral Mike Mullen this morning, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Really an interesting conversation. This he was former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for Presidents Bush and Obama. He offered McMaster this advice, especially concerning Trump advisor, now a permanent part of the National Security Council, Steve Bannon. This is, again, retired Admiral Mike Mullen, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That is a non-political body. There aren't many non-politicized entities left in Washington. Given the gravity of the issues that the National Security Council deals with, it is vital that that body not be politicized. And Bannon's presence as a member of that body politicizes it instantly. I've been at the table. I know the discussions. It's not one that you can ignore when you have a voting member, if you will, who's a political sitting at the table. If I had one bit of advice, I'd say go to the president, talk to the president about that, and see if there's a way to move Bannon off that council. And then certainly Mr. Bannon can give his political advice to the president
some other way.
Yeah.
Okay, Tim Hagel, what do you think about that advice from retired Admiral Mike Mullen, former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Do you think it's likely that the president would remove Steve Bannon as a permanent part of the NSC?
Well, apparently the public comments have suggested that certainly if McMaster wants that to happen, that the president would seriously consider it. We'll have to wait and see, and it would depend, I suppose, on how McMaster presented it. But I think that at the very least, and sort of following along with McMullen was saying, is the idea that because of the perception of Bannon being there makes it political, that makes it more difficult to sort of follow the advice of the council and so forth. And so for that reason alone, and even though you don't like the idea that, well, perception isn't always reality and so forth, but in this case, I think that Bannon has gotten enough flack from the opposition, sort of like Flynn did, that it would be more difficult for Trump to keep him there.
But is it in Trump's character to back away from a choice that he's made? Not very much in Trump's character, is it?
You know, it's the kind of a thing if you, and I can't recall exactly what they're called, but those sort of Chinese finger puzzles or thing where you get your fingers locked in there and the harder you pull, the tighter it is on you. So you have to find a way to ease it away. And so I think that's the way it is with Trump to a certain extent, okay, where if you sort of a head-on assault, he's going to dig his heels in, where if you kind of say, well, look, maybe this is better, we'll do it this way, find some other rule, then maybe you'll say, yeah, okay, we can go along with that. Because Trump does change his mind. We saw that lots during the campaign, so it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, do you think that's a possibility?
I think it is. I think even Steve Bannon may get on board with somehow stepping back, because Bannon's forte is politics, and he wants to achieve certain goals, and maybe removing himself from the National Security Council will aid him in politics. Yeah. The concern is that he's going to be in these meetings making security decisions or trying to influence security decisions. And that is something that I don't think anybody really agrees with. Right. If he's just in there trying to take the decisions that are made and then present them in a palatable way to the public, that's very different. But I think that can be worked around.
Right. And again, remind us, because we're not part of the high level of the government, the NSC, the National Security Council, is supposed to be, Dave, completely non-political. It looks after our national security regardless of the politics involved, right?
Yes, absolutely. And there was some noise made when Bannon was appointed onto the National Security Council that previous presidents have had similar political advisors attend meetings. Some of them even attended regularly. But their role was always to try to figure out what decisions were going to be made for the security concerns of the nation and then figure out a way to present that to the public. And that is sometimes necessary. When the United States uses its military or uses its intelligence apparatus to protect the nation, sometimes you have to inform the public, and you want to do that in a way that the public resonates with. What you don't want is a politically minded person influencing the decisions made. And I know a lot of political scientists are concerned about the fact that presidents typically get a boost in their approval ratings when the United States uses its military. We rally around the troops. And what we do not want is somebody in the room talking about national security concerns and saying, hey, we should really invade somebody because it would be good for the president's image. That's the real threat.
Okay. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. I wanted to get to one other point as we look at the political landscape over the last few days. During a visit to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the president, this was yesterday the visit, called the rise of anti-Semitism since his inauguration horrible.
This tour was a meaningful reminder of why we have to fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred in all of its very ugly forms. The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful, and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
Donald Trump speaking yesterday, one day after 11 bomb threats were phoned into Jewish community centers around the country and a Jewish cemetery in University City, Missouri, that was vandalized there as well. Explain a little bit, Tim, why this is notable and newsworthy coming from this president?
Well, it's newsworthy because he hadn't said some things. He hadn't initially criticized or spoken out against anti-Semitism or spoken out against those bomb threats and the vandalizing of the cemetery and so forth. And, you know, it's not a thing where you often will have presidents and other public figures immediately come forward and talk about how they, you know, detest this kind of violence or detest this sort of hatred or whatever it happens to be. And Trump has, as we've seen many times before, a different approach to these things. So he doesn't sort of have that politician's knack for knowing sort of when to speak out on certain things and when to not speak out on other things. He has a different approach. He does speak out on things that he wants to talk about and so forth. And he didn't see that it was, or he didn't understand sort of the need to do that right away. Basically, I think was thinking that, well, look, I'm not an anti-Semite, and of course, this is bad. Why do I need to comment on this? But then he got criticized for not doing so immediately.
My son-in-law is Jewish.
Jared Kushner, right?
Yeah. Okay. Very quickly, we have to go into a break in about a minute. Dave Anderson, your thoughts on this remark by the president?
It is being perceived, I think, as a little bit too little, too late. It wasn't followed up with any kind of declaration of, oh, we're going to do something about this. It was more of a, well, of course I oppose this and I condemn this. I don't understand why I have to talk about it. And it was followed up by Sean Spicer in a press conference then saying, well, you know, you guys in the press never give the president credit when he says this stuff. And the press largely saying, because he doesn't say these things when he should. We feel like we have to pressure him to get him on the record that he actually condemns anti-Semitism. And that's just not the norm for politicians.
We'll be back in just a minute with Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political scientists on this Politics Wednesday. We hope you'll join our conversation as well. Were you attending a town hall or a forum in the last few days with your elected official present? What happened? What did you want to communicate? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll hear a little of the raucous town halls when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. More of Politics Wednesday on River to River in just a moment after a short break. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, our two political scientists sitting in, giving us their insights on some of the points. There are so many, we can't get to all of them on the political landscape nationally, and we hope you'll join us as well, especially if you attended a town hall, a forum with your elected official, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, Congress in recess, that's why we have our elected representatives back home. A number of senators and representatives have been facing large, sometimes unhappy crowds at meetings in their districts and home states. Okay, there's a little bit of audio. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst faced a crowd of more than 100 at a forum in Maquoketa. The crowd, if you didn't quite make it out, chanting, "Do your job and work for us," reportedly raising questions about the climate change, plans to replace the Affordable Care Act. Senator Chuck Grassley, we heard in our news there, meetings in Iowa Falls and Garner yesterday, faced similarly large crowds, pointed questions, rambunctious, I think, That was our senator's words for their mood. Let me ask you, Tim Hagel, does this remind you of the first part of the Obama presidency? We had a lot of people pushing back there to changes that Obama was bringing. In what way is it different or the same?
Well, it's different to the extent that it's happening a lot earlier, that with you didn't say so, you're sort of referring to the Tea Party stuff and a lot of things that were going on there. And that didn't happen until a little bit later after Obamacare was passed and some other things going on. And it was more of a specific concern with economics and expansion of government and so forth. Whereas now it seems, although there are certain issues, a variety of issues that people that are concerned about, whether it's climate change or, you know, the concerns about Russia, the fact that, as Grassley said, Hillary lost and so forth, but it's less focused in that sense, and it's happening more as an opposition to Trump in general than it is something more targeted.
Mm. Here's an email from one of our listeners. This is Phil emailing us, writing, I did attend the Garner Town meeting yesterday. It was very contentious, in your face, and sometimes chaotic in tone. The Democrats are very ticked off, which he says includes himself. However, I did not get my message out to Grassley, which was the following. I wanted a reassurance from the senator that the U.S. will not abandon Europe or our other allies. Largely, the discussion revolved around domestic issues, such as DeVos, the Secretary of Education, and the future of the Affordable Care Act. Overall, I'm wondering, writes Phil, how effective the meeting was. The outrage is understandable, but will Grassley be responsive to such a hostile group? That's a question on my mind as well, Dave Anderson. Do these sort of outings with rambunctious people in the audience, do they sway our elected officials?
Yes, I think they do sway elected officials, and they certainly make them think more about what they're doing. Traditionally, in the United States, people don't like fast change. That we noticed that last time with Obamacare. People saw Obamacare as a very large, influential bill that was going to have big effects across the country. People didn't like that. They wanted to slow down and deliberate about it more. And I think that's what we're hearing right now, is that people are saying the Trump administration is pushing rapid change in lots of different areas. And they're asking their members of Congress to stand up against him and say, well, if we're going to have this change, let's at least deliberate about it and think about it first.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, when we think about the protests across the country that have marked the first month of the presidency of Donald Trump, we had started off with the Red Hat protest, the nationwide protest on inauguration weekend. We had the airport protests in reaction to the travel ban on seven Muslim-majority countries. The latest, just this week, I think it was called a Not My President's Day protest. Tim Hagel, can we say yet whether this is, when we go back to comparing it with the Tea Party, whether this is a movement rather than a series of protests?
It's probably too early to tell at this point. And again, my feeling, although, again, it's been going on for a while now, my feeling initially was that it just doesn't have the focus that it needs to be sustained. On the other hand, people are upset. Upset that, like they were actually back in 2000, early 2001, when George W. Bush didn't win the popular vote, and people were very unhappy about that. And so he faced a lot of resistance too, although that died down to a certain extent, especially after 9/11. But here we face a similar situation, and more so because Trump, unlike George W. Bush, they see as a less likable character, that they were unhappy with a variety of things that Trump had done and said during the campaign. And many Republicans were concerned too. And
so borne out by the approval ratings polls that Donald Trump has, very low and also even lower since Inauguration Day.
Yeah, although they've apparently ticked up recently to a certain extent, at least some polls. But again, if you were skeptical about the polls before the election, you might be skeptical
Donald
of
Trump
them now,
is certainly
too.
Skeptical about
but certainly
polls. Yes.
Many people have commented on the fact that he's the, you know, least liked president beginning of his term and so on and so forth. And that's probably going to, if not go down, at least continue to be polarized. And so in that sense, it's hard to see. But certainly Democrats would like to keep it going for, you know, 4 years at least, and maybe be able to weaken the president to keep him from doing the things that he promised from, again, from the left's point of view, whereas a lot of other people are maybe going to say, well, you know, maybe this is why you got Trump in the first place, is because you're not listening to what others, not quite so partisan, the folks in the middle, really want to get something done.
Let's go to our phones, a listener who was attending a town hall meeting, the same one that we had from our emailer in Garner yesterday. Daniel, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Glad to be on.
Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere you found there. Was the room full? How many people were there?
Well, I've been to quite a few town hall meetings before, and this was very unique. Usually, you know, it's not a lot of people, but this time it was crazy. The room was full, standing room only, going up the stairs out of the basement. They had it at the basement of the sheriff's building, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was many people outside that couldn't even get in at all. And
could you tell what most of the people wanted to communicate to Senator Grassley?
Well, there was kind of three main issues. One was they were opposed to the Secretary of Education. They was opposed to changing Obamacare. They wanted something installed to replace it before it's removed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was immigration. And there was this one lady there that was a Hispanic lady that was, you know, talking like she was afraid of being shipped out of the country.
Right.
And I talked to a few people that had come, and a number of them had actually been to the meeting earlier in their day with Chuck Grassley, and they drove up to Garner to be in that one also. They brought their picket signs, and I checked on the vehicles I was parked around, and, you know, 80% of them was from outside of Hancock County. There was one from Decorah, a few from Ames, a few from Des Moines. They had actually drove quite a long ways to be at Hancock County on Chuck Grassley's 99 county tour.
Okay, interesting, Daniel. We applaud your reporting skills as well, looking at license plates and so forth. Quickly, before we say goodbye to you, Daniel, how did that make you feel about our system? People are really down on politics in general, or regardless of party?
Well, I believe because this was a kind of a drive to bring out Hillary supporters, and it filled them with Hillary supporters from all over the state, that it kind of limited the people in Hancock County from actually getting to see their representative on this 99-county tour. So I felt kind of bad that it was like swamped with Hillary supporters and protesters yelling and shouting and not being civil.
Nope.
You know, it was very uncivil activity.
Okay, Dan.
And I felt bad. I felt this was not the way democracy is supposed to work, that, you know, everybody should have a right to speak, and you shouldn't be following politicians around the state yelling at them.
All right. Daniel, we'll leave it there. You've given us a good picture of what happened in Garner yesterday at the town hall meeting with Senator Grassley. Dave, what is the best way for an elected official to handle this type of pushback face-to-face?
I actually think town halls are a great way for them to do this. You have to allow your constituents to yell at you and express their anger and their frustration. And dodging that, I think, brings a lot of peril for elected officials because
right.
It looks like they're just ignoring voters. We saw this in 2009 when the Tea Party rose up and really went after Democratic members of Congress. And the members who were able to hold town hall after town hall after town hall seemed to fare a little bit better than those who just decided that this was too hostile of an environment and wouldn't talk to their constituents.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Constituents do something with that anger.
Okay, let's go to Ann in Maquoketa. Ann, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You attended, I understand, I see on my screen, a town hall meeting. This was with Senator Ernst.
Correct.
Where was it at?
And it was in the City Hall chambers in Maquoketa, and the chambers were overfilled. There were people. I managed to get in, so I could not see what the crowd was outside. But based on the sounds coming from out in the foyer area, there was a crowd out in the foyer area, too. But definitely the room was packed.
What message did you want to bring across to Senator Ernst?
Well, I did want to talk to Senator Ernst specifically about health care and my concerns about the environment. And based on posters that I saw people holding up, there were others there that had those same concerns. This was billed as a town hall meeting in some newspapers and notices, but in others it was billed as a veterans roundtable. And it was set up that way, too. When we came in, and then when Senator Ernst came in, she notified the crowd that she was going to speak. And then would we please let veterans ask their questions first, which everyone was fine with that. And the veterans' questions took up all of the time, except for one last person who was not a veteran and asked a question about health care. And then they said that was the last question, and they were done.
Mm-hmm.
And so people,
were the people, I think you're going there. Were the people satisfied then that they'd come and been heard?
No. I think that was the big concern, is that they realized that this was not going to be a, quote, open town hall meeting. It was pretty much controlled based on how she set up her agenda. So, you know, no one... The first people who were able to ask were the veterans, which is great because there are issues and that is an issue she's passionate about. But if you weren't a veteran, you did not, except for that one person, you did not get a chance to ask any questions yesterday.
Okay.
And I think that's what really upset people. And the previous caller who talked about people coming from out of county, I saw the same thing. There were licensed from a number of adjacent and even, you know, one county removed. But just like her follow-up meeting in Scott County last night was a closed meeting. So even though she was meeting in another one of her 99 counties, it was not open to the general public to come and meet with her. And I think that's a little unfair, and I think that's what's frustrating a lot of people.
Okay, Ann, thanks for your first your eyewitness reporting there as a participant at the town hall meeting in Maquoketa, where Senator Ernst was present. Both of our callers, Dave and Tim, have mentioned the Affordable Care Act. Republicans in the House say they'll soon introduce their legislative plans to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Of course, that's a big part of what Donald Trump ran on as well. Dave, what are you observing about the challenge of carrying through with that repeal and replacement pledge?
It is hideously difficult to do. It is very easy to run against a policy. Once the Affordable Care Act was passed, even before it was passed, Republicans were lockstep united against it. And that was really easy because they could say, here are the problems with it. When you actually have to confront removing it, though, you have to deal with the benefits of it. And there were a lot of benefits to the ACA. 20 million people got insurance who didn't previously have it. There are a lot of parts of the ACA that lots of people in the U.S. like the ban on pre-existing conditions, where insurance companies previously said, you know, if you're already sick, we won't cover you. Sorry, you're just not going to be able to access health care. People like this. And it's one thing to run against it for a while, but now that the Republican Party has to figure out a replacement, they're discovering that it may be too difficult to actually do that. No matter what they put in place, they are going to be vulnerable to attacks that whatever they do is potentially going to be more expensive than the ACA. It's potentially going to cover vastly fewer people. It's going to not offer the same benefits of the ACA. They're vulnerable no matter what they do right now.
Mm-hmm. Running out of time here. A lot of people still to get on. Let me just summarize. Suzanne calling from Grinnell. While people may have voted for Hillary, they were there to protest the priorities of this administration, not Hillary's loss there. So that referring to an earlier call. I'm afraid we don't have time for everybody to speak. Let's go to Deborah in Ames. Deborah, you attended that Iowa Falls town hall that we reported on in our news at the bottom of the hour. Your impression, what do you want to say about it?
Well, there's a few misconceptions I'd like to clear up. First, shouting at Grassley. Yes, there was some shouting, but it was Senator Grassley initially that asked people to shout out topics that they wanted to have discussed.
He actually said that, shout out topics.
He did say that. and people did respond with a number of topics. So he is the person that initiated that. And I'm not saying that he asked for everything that was shouted out, but he is the person that initiated the shout out. Secondly, to address the fact that activists came from all over the state. I am from Story County, and I am in Polk County a lot. Unfortunately, Senator Grassley is not. He doesn't show his face in Polk County. In Story County, his so-called part of the 99 county tour is to make a phone call. And those are not publicized. We don't know when they're happening. And so he's not connecting with us. So the only choice that people have is to go to the nearest place possible. And in my case, and the case of, you know, a number of people there, that happened to be Iowa Falls. We are not paid activists. I talked to several people from the Iowa Falls area who actually took time off from their jobs at no pay. They lost wages to come there and express their thoughts as citizens. And it's just, and Hillary was not mentioned, by the way.
Okay, Deborah,
we did not come up.
We're running out of time. A quick question for you, which I put to our political analysts. Do you sense this is a more than a protest in the first month of the Trump presidency? Is it a movement? We're talking, comparing it, of course, not in its aims, but in the way it's taking form into the Tea Party movement.
Well, in Iowa, it is coalescing into a movement. And it's not coalescing around the Democratic Party. So there.
Where is it coalescing then, if not the Democrats?
Among Bernie supporters.
Okay. Well, he ran for the Democratic Party nomination. Interesting that you should say that. Thank you. Thank you very much.
He was the Democratic Socialist. Let's be clear on that, too.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deborah, which brings us to an interesting point we can talk about here, too, very quickly. The Democratic National Committee voting this week for its next leader. There's a couple of top contenders. The representative Ed Ellison from Minnesota, Tom Perez, former Secretary of Labor. Tim, quickly, is this an important choice for the Democratic Party to see where it goes? As we heard from Deborah there, a more establishment figure being put in place, or what about someone who represents the, let's just say, the Bernie Sanders camp?
Yeah, and in fact, Bernie Sanders did endorse Ellison, as did Senator Warren. So he basically represents sort of the more, what would be called a more progressive side of things, although Perez basically has cred in that area too, and he's basically said that he wants to fight hard, but still he's seen as more the establishment-type candidate. And the question for either of them is going to be, well, will they be able to basically recover from the losses, of particularly in state houses and so forth, and find a way? People have talked about a 50-state strategy to try to build back up that bench that Democrats had before so that they can regain some of those lost seats and, from their perspective, eventually regain the presidency, if not in 2020, at least in 2024.
Dave Anderson, how do you see the Democrats' position as they choose another leader for the DNC?
I think it's a really difficult decision for them. And I really like Deborah's comment about how the resistance movement in Iowa is building up outside of the Democratic Party. That makes it a strong parallel to what happened with the Tea Party when it formed in 2010, that it formed outside of the Republican Party. And though it became kind of alongside the Republican Party, it has been notable for saying that it is much more closely adhering to their own beliefs than the Republican Party establishment. And I think the Democratic Party and the DNC chair has to keep an eye to this. There are a lot of people right now in the U.S. who don't consider themselves Democrats but are willing to be united against the Republican Party right now.
Mm-hmm. And so this is interesting. We have all this grassroots resistance seen in the protests across the country, heard from our callers today. So it's the ball is in, what would you say, Dave, the Democrats' party to see if, similar to the Republicans, lassoing, taking on board that energy of the Tea Party, the energy of whatever resistance, I guess it's been called indivisible, is one term it's been called?
Yes. The indivisible movement is, I think, rising right now. And one thing we've seen a lot over the last 10 years is wave elections. We had one in 2006 that was a reaction against the Bush administration. 4 years later, we saw another one as a reaction against the Obama administration. And it is very possible that in 2018 there will be another wave that will be against united Republican federal government. We just don't know what direction it'll take.
15 or 20 seconds for you, Tim Hagel, if you have a final thought for us before we go.
Yeah, it's hard to say what's going to happen in 2018. It depends a lot on what Trump administration does, what it's able to get done. If there's a lot of resistance to keeping him from accomplishing anything, that might actually undercut the possibility of a wave election in 2018.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Thank you both for stepping into our studios.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on this program, Political Junkies, now that I have your ears, you want to stay tuned tomorrow. Presidential historian Tim Walsh will be with us. Political scientist Kerry Covington will look at the latest rankings of the presidents of the past 44. What would be your favorite president? I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope to talk to you then.